I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. This weekend, our country marked 20 years since the terrorist attacks on September 11th. We commemorated our shared mourning, collectively recounted all that has been lost, and continued to search for meaning in the still unfathomable events of that day. Here on The Takeaway, we contributed in our own small way to these commemorative efforts by hosting a live conversation with Amane Alkataba, founder of MuslimGirl.com, and Mona El-Tahawi, writer of the Feminist Giant newsletter. I began by asking Amane what she remembered of that day, given that she was just 9 years old.
I remember a lot, actually, as young as I was, because of how severe life changed overnight. You know, even though you are a child, as children tend to do, you become very sensitive to the world around you, and especially how the world around you is treating you. And for me and my family, our lives were just completely turned upside down by this tragedy. I mean, I was born and raised in New Jersey. I grew up barely 30 miles away from Ground Zero. And 9/11 happened on my yearbook photo day when I was in elementary school. So it was definitely a significant day that's like seared into my memory. And what I remember the most after our unscheduled early dismissal that day was coming home to find my family huddled in the living room around our television set with what was happening on loop in front of us. And for me, I was still trying to perceive what that meant. What do you mean a plane flew into these buildings? What do you mean the buildings aren't there anymore? And my dad turned and looked at our family and said, they're going to blame us and it's going to get much worse. And from there, truly life as we knew it changed. I mean, for me, I was suddenly subject to extreme bullying in school. I heard my first racial slur in my elementary school classroom that same year. My family's, our house in our hometown was being targeted by the neighborhood kids that would water balloon and TP our home and egg it. And my family is, you know, the typical immigrant story where we've run an electronics store for most of my life. And as soon as 9/11 happened, the rest of the vendors in the flea market building where my family had their business band together to launch a petition to kick all of the Muslim businesses out of that building. So it was very significant. It was very trying, and it instilled a lot of fear into my young family. And I think that our story is among the most privileged of experiences immediately post 9/11.
Amane is American by birth and was still a child 20 years ago. But Mona El-Tahawi was an adult on 9/11, and she was a newly arrived immigrant from Egypt. Her recollections bring into full view just how dangerous the days after 9/11 were for Muslims in America.
I had moved to the United States the year before 9/11. I married an American. And we were living in Seattle at the time of the attacks. My brother and his wife were visiting us. And I remember the phone rang at 6 a.m. It just would not stop ringing. And it was my late ex-mother-in-law, because I'm now divorced and she has passed. And I picked up the phone and she said, turn the television on, turn the television on. Something terrible is happening in New York. The towers are falling. We turned the TV on. I ran upstairs to wake up my brother and his sister. And I remember I turned to them all and I said to them, if this is Muslims, they're going to round us up. We're going to be put in camps. I was terrified. And we did not leave the house for 2 days because my sister-in-law wore a headscarf. And we were really worried about her. We were in Seattle, which is supposedly this progressive, you know, liberal city. But we were really worried about her. And our worries were not unfounded because just a couple of days after 9/11, a man tried to set our local mosque on fire in Seattle. He was too drunk, and two Muslim men coming out of congregational prayers tried to stop him as he was pouring gasoline on the, you know, near the mosque grounds, and he tried to shoot them. And, you know, that, like I said, our fears were not unfounded, but soon after this failed arson attempt, the neighborhood around the mosque, not Muslims, but the non-Muslims, around the mosque, flooded the door of the mosque with bouquets of flowers because my now ex-husband drove us to the mosque to make sure everyone was okay. And there were just flowers everywhere and notes of support from the people in the neighborhood. And for the next 2 months, there were two people from those neighbors around the mosque standing guard outside the mosque every day, holding up signs saying Muslims are Americans to protect the mosque. So that was September of 2001. And, you know, you mentioned the attacks against Muslims and, you know, we talked about visibly Muslim women. I had a Muslim friend, a Muslim woman friend at the time, who, like me, does not wear a headscarf. She is visibly, well, she's brown. So I don't think that these racists could tell that she was South Asian. But she was leaving a restaurant in Seattle, again, you know, liberal, progressive Seattle, when a group of white men shouted at her white husband, "What does it feel like to f*** a terrorist?" So, you know, anyone who did not look white, anyone who was suspected, quote unquote, of being a Muslim, was being targeted for hate.
While both Amani and Mona had firsthand experiences of Islamophobic bias, bullying, and violence by individuals in the weeks and months following 9/11, both women insisted we should focus on official policies rather than interpersonal attacks. Amani began by reminding our audience of the National Security Entry and Exit Registration System, or NSERS, which was enacted in the months following 9/11.
NSERS program, which came to be during the War on Terror and still existed under Obama, was an actual nationwide database of Muslim men from a list of Muslim countries that we kept here, right? Like literally only men from specific Muslim countries, never mind the fact that Muslims come from every walk of life on the planet and every country on the planet, right? But this existed years before Trump's Muslim ban even became part of the conversation. Similarly, we still have the Patriot Act, which basically eliminates our due process rights as long as we come from our Muslim faith and somehow there's an accusation of terrorism there, even if not a single charge comes on you. But the Patriot Act allowed such invasive surveillance to take place within the Muslim community. And if we want to talk about feminism, let's talk about how Muslim women have been impacted by watching their fathers, brothers, husbands get abducted from the safety of their homes with no explanation and many times to never be seen again. These things have been, they happened immediately after 9/11 and they're still happening. Those policies are still in place. And that's what we should be focusing on. Like especially now that like I'm in my 20s, I'm sick and tired of having spent my entire life talking about Muslim women. No, let's actually talk about what's really important here and why we're allowing this treatment to take place within this time period right now. It's 2021.
Also emphasizing the structural, institutional, and political violence of post 9/11 federal policy, Mona El-Tahawi recounted how these government practices affected her family.
My brother was one of those Muslim men who had to submit to what this program called special registration. He and his Muslim friends, because it was a list of 25 countries and 24 of those countries were mostly in the so-called Arab world. And they had to have their pictures taken, they had to be fingerprinted, and they were put into a special registry. They couldn't move without checking in with the FBI. They couldn't leave the country without getting security clearance. My brother did not leave the United States for 10 years straight because he was worried that he would lose his student visa and his work and his income, because several of his Muslim friends did. And I talked about how we were together in Seattle when the 9/11 attacks happened and a man unsuccessfully tried to set my local mosque on fire. That same brother of mine lives in the Midwest where he submitted to so-called special registration. And an arsonist actually succeeded in setting his mosque on fire in 2012. So that's 11 years after the 9/11 attacks. My nieces and nephews were in that mosque just hours before it was gutted by a fire by a man who said that he had watched Fox News, and Fox News had told him that, or he learned from Fox News, that Muslims were killing Americans around the world and he wanted to fight back and teach Muslims a lesson. And so he set a mosque in the Midwest on fire. So that mosque took a while, you know, they fundraised and they rebuilt again. And I'm bringing it up, not just to talk about how it was set on fire, as many other mosques around the country were set on fire. I refuse to allow my nieces and nephews to grow up in a country where being Muslim, where being brown, and being Egyptian is going to be used against them for something they had nothing to do with. Their father was visited by the FBI a month after 9/11 and by a special agent and asked, do you know anyone who celebrated 9/11? What the actual hell, you know, and had to be subjected to this special registration. So enough.
As our conversation continued, we moved away from the immediate post 9/11 moment and considered a broader sweep of global and domestic experiences. I asked Mona about her reactions to the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th.
Melissa, it has been incredible, and I don't mean it in a good way. I mean, incredulous, maybe, to watch the reaction following the insurrection, following January 6th. And, you know, I want to tie that to what also happened in Texas with the abortion case, with the election of Trump, and with the growing boldness of white supremacy and Christian fundamentalism in this country. And, you know, very soon after I arrived in the United States, because I moved here in the year 2000, and, you know, I'd been a news reporter in the Middle East for over 10 years. I'm from Cairo, from Jerusalem. I grew up in Saudi Arabia, like I said. So I was very familiar with following Islamic fundamentalism, Jewish fundamentalism when I lived in Jerusalem. You know, and here I am in the United States. And it became very clear very soon after I arrived that Christian was the default and white was another default. And if you were a white Christian and you wanted your religion in your politics, that was perfectly fine. And if you invaded the Capitol, you know, the height, the seat of American political power, you know, holding up signs saying Jesus is our Lord and, you know, taking, basically wanting to assassinate the vice president. So wanting to assassinate the second most powerful person in the US and the third, Nancy Pelosi. But because you're Christian and you're white, it was what? It was perfectly okay. Some of them were calling themselves revolutionaries. Who went to their home and asked them, do you know anyone who celebrated January 6th? Who was insisting that they submit to a special registration where they are fingerprinted and photographed and they can't move house without alerting the FBI? Who indoctrinated them and made them into these radicals? And who is apologizing to the rest of us for the terror that they subjected us to? So clearly, there are not just double standards, there are triple and quadruple standards in the United States, depending on your religion, your ethnic background, your gender, your class, your ableism, your sexuality, your gender, so much. And January 6th, I mean, if the election of Donald Trump was a reminder, because Donald Trump is not an aberration. This is why, thank you for reminding us of Alabama, Melissa, and the church bombings by white supremacists, and the internment of Japanese Americans in concentration camps. This is white supremacy at work. And white supremacy is the reason that Donald Trump was elected. And white supremacy is the reason that my brother's mosque was set on fire. And white supremacy and its terrorism is the reason that the insurrection on January 6th has not had as massive a consequence on the evangelical community as 9/11 had on the Muslim community. And additionally, I want to remind people that COVID-19 has killed more Americans than 9/11 had. And I hold Donald Trump and Fox News and all of those other propaganda outlets directly responsible for a form of genocide that has disproportionately affected Black, Indigenous, Brown, and disabled and working class Americans. And yet, who has been held accountable to that? Multiple times Americans have been killed because of COVID than they were on 9/11. This is not to excuse or diminish 9/11, but this is to remind people that white supremacy gets away with multiple crimes, and it's time to hold it accountable.
Mona's discussion of this political double standard, which renders Muslim communities as permanent outsiders, made me curious about Amani's decision to run for Congress back in 2020. I asked her about how she reconciled her experiences of being treated as a second-class citizen with her desire to serve as an elected representative. Apparently, the question touched a point of pain.
Thanks, Melissa, for driving home the crisis that has completely fueled my inner turmoil with this entire experience with running for office. And it's a conversation that I've had with so many of my peers and colleagues, right? I mean, the whole reason why I was inspired to run for office at such a young age was because I got to
see visible examples in Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib and in Ilhan Omar, and that that was possible, you know? And so, and I think that their work is necessary, but one of the political experiences that actually defined my approach to social justice early on was that immediately after college, before I really focused on Muslim Girl as a platform, I actually moved straight to Washington, D.C., and I started working for a civil rights organization there. And while I was there, you know, this young, fresh-spirited person ready to change America and stuff like that, that year was actually one of the biggest controversies that hit the Muslim American community, which was when President Barack Obama invited Muslims for the national iftar at the White House in the midst of Gaza being bombed. And that, I think that really brought to light that fragmentation within our community, because then you saw half of our community, you know, the institutional leaders were inside the walls of the White House, rubbing shoulders with the president and the administration. And then you saw the other half of the community, the activists, protesting at the picket with the picket signs outside of the fence, you know, demanding the change to actually happen that we weren't seeing. And so witnessing that conflict early on, I think that was what really solidified my departure from Washington right after college, because I was like, what will make me more effective? To be another body on the ground, or to amplify or to create a platform where we can amplify thousands, if not millions, of voices like mine, and we can really be a force. And then, of course, you know, that has been a constantly evolving, again, inner conflict for me over the years. It resulted in me last year witnessing my mom get COVID in the midst of our government's sheer just incapability of addressing this crisis that we were in. And I felt like the only way that I could really push back was to take the bull by the horns myself, you know, and run against an incumbent that's been in his seat for my entire lifetime, an old white guy that has been not representing my community or my voice for the longest time in my entire life. And so, you know, I think that now I'm kind of in a place where I feel like we need people at every level. You know, what we're going up against right now is just so severe that, you know, the folks on the inside of the White House wouldn't have had any type of power if not for the protesters on the outside of the White House pushing for that change. And similarly, the people on the outside might not have had that communication factor if not for the members of our community that were inside those walls and being able to make that engagement happen. So I think that it definitely goes both ways. And this isn't a new conversation whatsoever. I think this is something that has plagued so many minority communities that have had fights that they've had to fight against adversity. And we're all still trying to figure that out. But I think that, of course, you know, the idea is that we really have to dismantle the system in place that is oppressing us in the first place. And right now, as we witness the people coming on social media and coming online, getting younger and younger by the day, you see that people are recognizing that the system that we have, especially our justice system, it wasn't made for so many of us. And in that way, you know, it does bring into question, where is our place in the system? And can the system even exist in the future moving forward?
Thank you to Amani Akataba, founder of MuslimGirl.com, and Mona Eltahawe, writer of the Feminist Giant newsletter. You can see our entire Takeaway Live conversation on our Facebook page, facebook.com/thetakeaway.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.